Hello, I am Pete Real, a high school English and Spanish teacher, an avid reader, and an aspiring writer. Thank you for listening to the Chills at Will podcast, in which we explore the visceral beauty of literature and its connection to our culture, our history, and ourselves. Hello and welcome to episode 82 of the Chills of Will podcast. It's a pleasure today to be joined by Sara El Kamel. I wanted to make sure I pronounced her correctly. El Kamel. Sara is a poet and journalist living between her hometown of Cairo, Egypt and New York City. She holds an MA in arts journalism from Columbia University and is currently an MFA candidate in poetry at New York University, where she taught in the undergraduate creative writing program. Her poems have appeared in The Common, Michigan Quarterly Review, Four Way Review, The Boiler, Memorious, Wildness, Nimrod International Journal, The Rumpus, Jet Fuel Review, etc. Her work has also been featured as part of the anthologies Best New Poets 2020, Best of the Net 2020, The Breakbeat Poets Volume 3, Halal If You Hear Me, that's pretty good stuff, and 20.35 Africa, Volume 2. She was named a 2020 Gregory Jenkian, pardon me if I mispronounced it, scholar by the Adroit Journal and a finalist in Narrative Magazine's 30 Below contest in the same year. Her debut chapbook, Field of No Justice, will be published by the African Poetry Book Fund and Akashic Books in 2021. She has designed and facilitated, often collaboratively, a number of creative writing workshops in art spaces and cultural institutions in Cairo, Alexandria, and Amman, Jordan, including at the Cairo Institute of Liberal Arts and Sciences, CILAS, the Townhouse Gallery, and Medrar for Contemporary Art. You're on fire. 2021, 20, and 2020 have been good for you, huh?
They really have, yes.
Welcome, and thanks so much for giving of your time. It's a pleasure to talk to you. How are you today?
I'm good. Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be talking to you.
Well, you were telling me before we started recording that you spent a lot of time in Cairo, you know, COVID and since, I think up until about August. As you get back into New York City life and all of that, what are you working on teaching-wise, writing-wise?
So I'm currently trying to work on my thesis for, I'm in my last semester at NYU doing the MFA in poetry. So I'm kind of looking at everything I've produced over the past 2.5 years and trying to make it coherent. So I guess I'm working on this project, possibly a manuscript in the future that's all about containment and confinement, and which are themes that I've been working on for a number of years, but I think it's only just becoming clear to me that that's the project. So yeah.
Wow. I have very little knowledge of the MFA, like thesis, especially with poetry, I would say, right? I spoke to a gentleman named Andrew Liu, really good poet who got his MFA through Cal State Long Beach. But anyways, you know, reading his thesis, which like you said, you know, may become a manuscript, hopefully, there's so much like metacognition going on, right? Where, sure. Am I correct in saying that you're really having to like, not explain your poetry, but like you said, coherent. I kind of just wonder about that process of making your poetry coherent, because poetry is kind of by nature sometimes, right? Subjective, and you know, there's not necessarily one right answer. I wonder how you kind of like putting order to something that's maybe not ordered by nature.
Right. I think you're completely right. There's something that's very strange about curating what you're writing. And I think it's the same for many other poets. I can't decide what piece I'm going to write as I come to the page. It just happens. Whatever is calling, I respond and that's it. So I think it's a good thing that they don't make us decide what our thesis is on when we first get into the program.
Oh, okay.
So it's the final semester, and you kind of look at the work that you have and try to see if there is a theme. And then I think, at least in my own experience, I feel like I'm constantly surrounding myself with material that will feed into subjects that I'm already interested in. Mm. So like womanhood, ancient Egyptian mythology, the revolution in Egypt, and yeah, more womanhood and gender, okay. And where that fits into everything political and otherwise. So I think there is a self-selection that happens as I write and as I think about poems. And then, so now I'm just framing things, and which is, I guess it's part of the game, unfortunately, where like you have to make yourself marketable or, yeah, like, how would you describe your project is a question I get asked a lot. So, yeah.
That's interesting. I mean, you know, I mean, in the best sense of the word, I got my understanding is, you know, a lot of poetry is kind of being rebellious in a way. And so it's like, you know, like you said, to like stand in front of a group and be like, this is what it's about.
Mm-hmm.
When by definition, you're like, I don't want to tell you what it's about. You know?
Yes. Sometimes I don't know what it's about.
Yeah. Going back in time a little bit, I wonder about your relationship with language, with literature, poetry as a kid and growing up. You know, was it a print rich environment where you grew up? Did you seek out literature? Was it something that came a little bit later in life?
I mean, so I grew up in Cairo and I went to school there. My father was always encouraging us to read, me and my sister. And they, at the school I went to, they would have a book fair every term.
Nice.
And he would give us money to spend at the book fair, and that was like my favorite day of the, mm-hmm. of the year.
Mm-hmm.
But I just read, you know, Harry Potter and Sweet Valley High.
All right.
Yeah. But I was also a very good student in general, and one of my favorite subjects was definitely English. And we read a lot of Shakespeare for some weird reason in Cairo.
Yeah.
And then we also read Of Mice and Men, which was very like an early introduction to symbolism and metaphor and narrative arc. And we also read A Streetcar Named Desire. So okay. we read a mix of like novels and plays. I didn't feel like I wanted to write fiction, but I felt inclined to write creatively. And I remember writing poems when I was maybe 15, 16 and giving a stack of them handwritten on like messy paper to my English teacher. And he just gave them back to me. With like no response whatsoever. I kept looking for any notes, but there were none. So I was disheartened a bit. But yeah, I'm very much bilingual. So I also grew up reading Arabic, mostly the Quran, actually. That's probably the book I've read most in my life. I think it was later in life that I started reading poetry. I do remember this one book called Beirut 39, and it's a book of writing by Arab writers who were below the age of 39. And I think I read that 10 years ago or something. And that's when I first felt like, oh, I think I want to do that. And they were also hybrid works, so they were in so many different forms. Oh yeah, we also read a lot of Seamus Heaney in school. So yeah, and T.S. Eliot. It's just so bizarre that I was exposed to these things all the way in Egypt. but I remember also being fascinated with Prufrock. And yeah, but I studied journalism first in Cairo, and then I came to New York in 2014 to do a master's in arts journalism. And I quickly realized that I was more interested in art than I was in journalism, but I had invested so many years working as a reporter and editor that I just put off the transition to poetry for as long as I could until I couldn't anymore.
It's a cool way to describe it. You put it off as long as you could. You physically could not put it off any longer, right?
Yeah.
Did what you read about the United States, like of Mice and Men, kind of takes place kind of close to where I am, you know, like Central Coast of California, more like Northern California. Did you feel like you got an idea of what the states were like when you got to the states? Were you just like, this is totally different, or did you feel like you got enough of a variety of, you know, the United States to kind of get it as you read?
Yeah, I think I had it easy because I went to New York first, and it's New York feels so familiar because of the movies. So I feel like I could just recognize the streets and everything.
Gotcha.
So it wasn't like a huge shock. My dad also went to school in Chicago. And we visited the US a number of times when I was a child. So I wasn't a complete stranger, but it's still overwhelming to be in New York.
Worst traffic in Cairo or New York City?
Well, I never take cars in New York City, so I don't
There you go, there you
know.
go. That,
But
that's
yeah,
smart.
but
That's smart.
traffic is pretty bad in Cairo.
Okay. We talked about reading the Quran, especially growing up. Were you slash are you able to, like, kind of in an objective way, like, look at it as like as literature and the po like what about the writing, the poetry of it maybe influenced you?
I think whatever influence the Quran had on me, I don't know it consciously. Like I can now think about it and say the repetition, maybe, and the metaphorical language, and then also the very vivid images.
I see.
Like there's so much fruit in the Quran. There's so much landscape. There's drama, there are characters. So I'm sure there was an influence, but I don't think when I was reading it at a young age, I was thinking of it as literature. I was just, trying to understand it.
Well, you know, I mean, as you know way better than I do, like there are great poetic traditions in the Middle East, North Africa, you know, a lot in Farsi, for example. I think of like Khalil Gibran, the Lebanese American, right? The prophet. Is there anything about Arabic, the language, that lends itself to poetry? Like the makeup of the language itself?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people ask me why I write in English and not Arabic, and they would say Arabic is so much richer than English, which is probably true there. I think there's such an expansive vocabulary in Arabic. And like one word can mean 20 different things. And it also sounds great. Versus English, which just to me sounds okay,
I don't think guttural is the word, right? But English being more like, I don't know. I don't want to get into all the open mouth, closed mouth, you know, linguistics. I have bad memories taking linguistics class, but I know what you mean. It's
Right.
not as free flowing, I guess, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah. So I don't know. I do think that something about Arabic is okay. If we're thinking of poetry as like trying to describe or capture emotion, and memory and events and like all the things that make up a life, in as creative and original ways as possible, I can see why Arabic would afford us that because there are just more words and possible like syntax is also
okay,
very flexible and fluid and changeable. But yeah, I don't know. My biggest fear is that my English will run out. But I think that's apparently a common fear among poets. Like even Anne Carson, who's one of my favorite poets, she always says that she believes that every person is born with a finite amount of language. And then when it runs out, it runs out.
Dude.
Yeah.
Oh, man. So you talk about like at those book fairs, which I loved as well, by the way. And I'm so excited. I saw my daughter's a kindergartner. I saw they're having their first, you know, Scholastic book fair coming up. I'm like, yeah, those are great memories. So, you know, I mean, you were picking, you talked about some of the books you read in school. What were the transformative texts, I guess, as you got older that you were picking on your own, or maybe you read in class, maybe they were assigned, but what were, I don't know if you've kind of talked about some, but what were some transformative texts as you got older that were just like, whoa, that, you know, thrilled you and continue to?
There is a poem in this book I mentioned earlier, The Anthology of Writing by Arab Writers. Mm-hmm. The poem is called A Little Sugar, and it's by the writer Hussein Jalad, who I actually had never heard of and never read anything else by him since then because I can't find it online. But it's set in New York of all places, and I read it years before I moved here. And so that's something I consider to be really seminal in the way that I think of poetry and prose poetry. It's written as a letter with these, the focus keeps shifting, like some parts are addressed to this lover and other parts are more like journal entries. So that was really moving for me. And then when I first really started to engage with poetry, I was in the MA at Columbia, and I took one of my electives in the MFA program with Alan Ziegler, who's an amazing poet and teacher. And the whole class was based on, it was called Short Prose Forms. Mm-hmm. So we read a lot of prose poetry, and I think Ben Lerner was another person who really was formative. And I think I was drawn to prose poetry before verse because maybe it just felt more accessible to me and less intimidating, or I didn't have to figure out what the form was doing exactly. It was just you know, under this guise of a paragraph or a piece of prose, and then you discover everything else that it is. So yeah, Carl Phillips was also one of the first poets I read. I can't remember how I first encountered him, but I'm so grateful that I did. And Anne Carson, my boss when I was working in journalism in New York after my master's, he gave me a hard time, but he also gave me a book by Anne Carson, the Autobiography of Red. And I will forever be grateful because that also just kept me really hungry for a more intense engagement with poetry because it was just so different than everything, definitely different from Seamus Heaney and T.S. Eliot and used language in ways that directly spoke to me. So I felt like, oh, I want to speak back.
Sure. I mean, you've been educated and been a teacher in, you know, in fairly recent years, like contemporary poetry, contemporary MFA, MA, etc. Does there continue to be like a big push away from form, like actively pushing away from form and more formal, or is that just something that has kind of happened naturally, or am I misreading it and there's still a lot of formal writers?
I feel like form now is more of a game. So it's like, oh, why don't you try writing a villanelle as this exercise, you know, as if that's just cosmetic, you know. I don't think like it feels like a very active choice for contemporary poets to write in form. And which is cool that it's still happening, but it's a choice. Like you can, and I think poets today are also writing in so many different forms. Like, you know, you have a single poet who writes sonnets and villanelles and pantoums and centos and like nothing, you know? So it's, I feel like the toolbox is really expanding, which feels freeing. That you can write in form or not write in form, and
how do you prevent just like gibberish? If there's no form, then I'm just going to put words that come to mind and phrases and images that may have absolutely no link. You know, how do you keep yourself organized and when there is no form, I guess?
You mean me personally or poets in general?
I guess you personally, yeah.
I really feel like I have learned, if there's one thing I learned in the past 6 years that I've been writing poetry very regularly, is how to sift through the gibberish and find the gold or the silver. So I really feel like the more you put in the hours, the more you just learn how to revise and then there are also these ideas that I started picking up from the MFA, like narrative poetry, and like, so I'm thinking about structure with beginning, middle, and end, and thinking about themes and how they emerge as images. So there are like tools, I think, to, even if the poem is not in a strict form, it still has ghosts of form, or
that makes sense. Do you love editing, hate editing, know this is part of the game? How does your editing process work?
I love it so much.
All right.
Yeah, I'm a compulsive reviser. And like almost all my poems right now are in their 10th or 11th drafts. I also feel like it's so much easier than writing. Like starting with nothing is torture. Sure. But I also am loving revision more and more because I'm getting better at it. And I think as a person, I don't like doing anything I'm not good at. I have confidence in myself as an editor of my own poems. But I don't think I will ever have confidence in myself as a writer, just because I feel like every time I write a poem, it's the last one I'll ever write. Sense of like that I have nothing now on a page, or there is an empty page waiting and I don't know exactly what's going to fill it. Like this complete not knowing is really frightening. And I don't know. I wonder if it's just part of what makes it exciting. Sure. But sometimes I wish it was different. Yeah. I wish it was, you know, like my editor assigning me something at the newspaper and I'm just like writing what I know or what I can find out through interviews or through research. But this poetry thing is so much more, there isn't a direct route to the page.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if only there were, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do you do a lot of reading aloud, like not necessarily the public appearances, but like as part of your revision? How important is the sound?
The sound is so important, but I I know the sound, so it plays in my head.
Right.
I don't physically read aloud, like, but before I do a reading, I will practice out loud. It usually just sounds exactly the same way as it does in my brain. I also sometimes try reading my poem in other people's voices. So my friend Hannah Matheson, a poet, also in the MFA program at NYU, she has such a gorgeous reading voice. So sometimes I will read my poem in her voice and see if that works. And I do that with other friends too.
Wow. You talk about imitating others' voices. You're literally imitating their voices?
In my head, yes.
Okay.
Wow. Yeah, I have the sample. Wow. And it's crazy that I'm tone deaf. I would have never guessed.
Well, it works for you, so I'm gonna start trying to do that. The idea of deciphering poetry, like, you know, like, oh, this means this, and you know, I come at it as a high school teacher where, you know, we're looking for symbolism, and this right. metaphor is, you know, why these two comparisons, what are the two things being compared, why is there like a danger in like trying to overanalyze or decipher, like, you know, figure out the right answer?
I mean, yes, I think there is a danger because you lose the abstraction, or there is a risk of losing the abstraction and losing the magic of, because when you make a metaphor, you're involving the reader, you're asking them to collaborate with you because you're giving them these two things and you have connected them, but you're asking them to connect them. And then each of these things, like the vehicle and the tenor, I think they're called, they could mean each of them, even if you're saying like you're comparing milk with wood, for example, for whatever reason, like milk looks one thing for me in my head and then something else for the reader, etc. So I think it's really, sometimes playful and an opportunity to get the reader to be a participant in your own poem. Mm. But definitely in the MFA, like, I think yesterday I had office hours with a professor and they were like, oh, I can't see this metaphor because I like both things to be physical. That you're comparing with to each other, and someone else said something else about like how they prefer a metaphor to be. So and again, when you're in a program that comes with its own professors and its own like set of people and direction, there is a risk of you just writing towards that or changing your own style. Of course, there are so many opportunities and I'm learning so much, but I'm also excited to be writing on my own and like, because it might be more free. And then I'll probably just use everything they told me anyway. But I do think there needs to be space for ambiguity.
A wise woman named Sara El Kamel said, quote, "I feel like my work is a collage of the people I meet, the things I read, the places I go, and what kind of things stay in me and with me. I also try to incorporate objects in my poems that would symbolize something for the reader." So are you like iPhone notes going through your regular day, you know what I mean? Taking down objects and images, this whole idea of the collage, how does that work? Are you like actively working, actively thinking about poetry, or is it just something kind of just happens when it happens?
I'm thinking about poetry almost every day. Mm. Like every day, obviously, but maybe 90% of the time. And to like a strange extent, like even if something bad happens to me, I'm like, oh, maybe it will at least go in a poem, which I know is not healthy, or maybe it is, I don't know. But yeah, I do take notes. I watch movies with a notebook in my hand just to take down any snippets of dialogue or images that I am drawn to. I also take pictures of even just colors that I want to describe. I'm still a journalist in that way. Like I'm looking, paying attention, and I don't know, maybe I'm also manufacturing conversations sometimes, just to, like, or asking people questions in the same way that I would do in a journalistic interview, but like a poetry interview kind of thing.
Okay.
Maybe.
Yeah. You talking about describing colors. I was reading today that, I don't know where, but scientists invented like the whitest possible white paint.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking, I was like, there's some art to be had there. Like, I guess in some way they can eventually use it for like air conditioning.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Like, I guess if the walls are as white as, but I was like, whoa, what does that even mean? Like as white mm-hmm. as can possibly, mm-hmm. but then maybe in 10 years they invent something, you know what I mean? So maybe that's our muse or something like that. I don't know.
That's so funny.
Right.
Yeah. I was just going to say, I just bought a big tube of white paint because I paint also, and white always runs out first.
Okay.
So I just bought like a massive bottle of it.
I'm not going to say you made a bad purchase, but it may be obsolete.
You know what I mean? Right, it's not.
in 2 weeks, it may be shipping out the most. Man, I don't know. I thought maybe it'd be, you know, like I was telling you, I think before we were recording, it's impossible to get, you know, the perfect poetry to represent you. I picked three that I hope were fairly representative. I was hoping maybe we could look at the first is Field of No Justice.
Yes.
This was from the Four Way Review, where you had three poems published. There's always talk, right, about like, I see all the memes and stuff on poetry Twitter and all that about like, I'm not the speaker, but I am the speaker. I'm saying I'm not the speaker, but I am, you know, that kind of thing. I just wonder about the idea of the speaker of this poem as like representative of the whole,
mm-hmm.
or like a very specific individualized speaker. Like, is this speaker representative of a bigger group or very unique?
So this poem, Field of No Justice, is based on this idea that in ancient Egypt, when someone would die, a sparrow would carry their soul to the gods.
Mm.
And then the gods would weigh the heart. And if the heart was heavier than a feather, then the person would go to hell. And if it was lighter than a feather, then they would go to the Field of Reeds, which means heaven.
Hmm.
So this is like a story that I came up with one person who their soul or their heart was actually switched out by the sparrow that was supposed to carry their heart to heaven or to the gods for the the weighing ceremony. And they, like in the myth, they would, or the story as recorded in the Book of the Dead, like this book on funerary rituals and death rituals in general in ancient Egypt. And they said that the deceased would give out these declarations of purity to convince the gods that they are worthy of heaven. Wow. So I thought, okay, why don't I do declarations of impurity?
Uh-huh.
So the speaker here is like one woman who is, by this weird twist of fate, going to heaven, even though she feels she doesn't deserve it because she hasn't been pure.
Wow.
So, but it's, yeah, definitely an imagined speaker, imagined setting, everything. Just, you asked me about research before or collage before.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, I happened to attend a talk by a playwright who was working with the Book of the Dead. So I read the script and then I read parts of the Book of the Dead, and this is kind of the culmination of all that research. So yeah, so I think it's an imagined speaker, and I often do that with my poems that are based in history or mythology.
Okay. One one of the lines is, you talked about obviously about the whole weighing of the heart.
Mm-hmm.
Quote, the heart on the scale is the heart of a sparrow. My heart is the heart of a sparrow. And I just think it's very interesting, this idea of giving the dead a voice, giving the dying a voice, you know. In one of your interviews, you talk about the bird is a very common motif. You know,
yes.
The sparrow, of course. You know, there's Maya Angelou with I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the overriding thing why you use birds so often, this idea of freedom and flight? Or what is it about the bird that appeals to you?
Partly, yes, the idea of freedom, which is something I'm very concerned with, specifically after the revolution in Egypt. But I'm also just, you know, when you have a motif that keeps coming back and you don't even know why. So I think I don't know yet why I'm using birds so much.
I like
I'm
that.
Hoping I will figure it out one day.
Yeah, work in progress, yeah.
Yes.
Still trying to figure it out. You know, surrealism as a whole was pretty much, was in many ways a reaction to fascism.
Mm-hmm.
Does that sound right?
Yeah.
You know, so not exactly the same thing. I wonder about like maybe the specifics of surrealism in like the Egyptian tradition,
mm-hmm.
whether that was, you know, more quote unquote old days or more like with the revolution, which was recent.
Surrealism in Egypt was, there was a movement that was happening in parallel to the one in Europe. And like actually Egyptian surrealist painters and writers met with Breton, who was probably the most famous surrealist in France. So it was very popular then in like the context also of colonialism by the British and then the post-colonial phase where like a lot of people were suffering from poverty and just this shakeup of society and economy. So it was really popular then as the way to imagine the future, the post-colonial future and what nationalism could look like. And but at least in visual art, I haven't seen a strong surrealist movement in the aftermath of the revolution of 2011, but definitely in writing by young Egyptians. I feel like, yeah, there are a lot of dystopian landscapes and strange creatures and a bit of sci-fi writing. And so in a way, I guess a new surrealism wave is happening because there's like a similar sense of failure, like in the 20th century. It's kind of deja vu for a lot of people. Yeah. And I'm a huge fan of surrealism.
Mm-hmm.
And I find myself circling back to it all the time.
Right. Yeah. I just wonder, like, artists of all types, writers, visual artists, about, you know, in the world we're in today, it's like, what's left to, like, how do you do dystopia anymore? How do you do dystopia anymore in this type of world? You know, it just seems like it might be like a creative block almost.
Dystopia is just reality right now.
Right. The Wadi, the second poem would be The Language of the Body. Is Wadi Rum, am I pronouncing that correctly?
Wadi Rum, yeah.
What's the significance of that beautiful, you know, natural landscape? What was it that drew you to that?
So I was, in 2018, I did the residency called Spring Sessions. And it's usually a residency that takes place in Amman in Jordan.
Okay.
But for that year, the curators decided to make it a walking residency. So we walked from the north of Jordan to the south of Jordan in 45 days. The poem came out of the residency because Wadi Rum, this crazy red desert, was one of the places where we walked through and stayed in for a few days because it was too hot to walk, actually. Yeah.
I'd love to, if possible. You don't have to. You know, being that it's fairly short, I wonder if you might read it.
Yeah, of course.
I can, you know, have it here for you as you read.
Okay. The Language of the Body, for Yvonne. We pull the black of rum over our eyes like skin. God's earth is vast, vast, vast. But by day, she wrapped her limbs around my limbs and drew my air. I follow her into the dark, consider saying, please, I don't know what you need, but all I see is red. At the foot of the dunes, I push her, soft as the sin that tips the scale. I run away like a ghost, a demon, a silent drum in the faultless dark, not a quiver of light around my bones. Sleep blinks in me like a lazy wind. Convinced our tent is blind, I keep stealing water from Yvonne and dried apricots and dates and citronella for the bugs, but I feel guiltiest about water. What angel would come to my funeral now? Funeral now, funeral now, funeral now. I listen to her weep, and everything that has ever pushed time stops pushing. The things that look like walls tire, leave the desert open and cold. Even as the mean sun yawns, Yvonne's kalimba does not stop. Every note and needle, needle, needle in my skin. Until the sand around me turns red, the hour turns red, and the moon itself, I think I see it, turn red. God's earth is vast, but sometimes a body finds itself alone on the dunes, a cancerous fist inside her breast. I want, I want, I want to hold my hand out like cups, scoop the cancer from her chest, and feed it to the sand.
Beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you.
The I want, I want, I want, the last, I guess, three, four lines, the repetition, the desire, the generosity, the unselfishness is a beautiful and profound way to end it. There are a lot of repetition, including, I assume, the one that's in italics. Mm-hmm. Is that supposed to be like a literal echo, like in this open landscape?
Yes.
What do you feel like you accomplished with repetition?
This was actually, I was in Catherine Barnett's workshop my first semester, and she gave us an exercise to just go crazy with repetition while working on a draft. So I just did so much of it, and mm-hmm. then it felt right for this poem, like as something that's set in a hollow place, but also
sure.
Like the acoustics there are crazy. Everything there is crazy.
Right.
So yeah, so I found it fitting, but it was really a prompt-based revision, this one.
I found it interesting, just the idea of like no borders, no walls, just, you know, just mm-hmm. vast open landscape, and just, I guess, kind of like sinning out in the open. And this, the speaker's, you know, kind of, I mean, speaker's talking about feeling guilty and admitting, you know, that I, you know, stole water,
mm-hmm.
you know, that kind of thing. And like you said, the surrealism, like the red moon, you know, right. I myself, the speaker says, maybe feel like I'm turning red.
Mm-hmm.
And especially on hearing you read it, I was drawn to the line, I listened to her weep, and everything that has ever pushed time stops pushing.
Mm-hmm.
What a great description of time stopping, of, you know, just, yeah. And also I don't know, I feel like there's like an idea of more fate than personal choice,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
that time itself has stopped pushing, like I had, you know, the speaker had no role in it,
right?
Besides the writing exercise, and I love writing exercises,
mm-hmm.
you talked about the walking tour, how mm-hmm. did you say, walking residence, is this like a dedication, is this like a, you know, I kind of wonder a little bit about the genesis, if you don't mind sharing.
Yeah, it's dedicated to my friend Yvonne Buchheim, who's a visual artist from Germany, but she lived in Cairo for a number of years, and we have a complicated friendship, and I feel like I wasn't always the best friend that I could be, but I love her dearly, and we collaborated a lot, taught workshops together that were writing and drawing and performance, and we had so much fun coming up with prompts and syllabi. But yeah, and then she got sick a couple of years ago, and of course I've been really worried about her, and all the guilt that I had already been feeling about letting her down as a friend was exacerbated by the fact that she was sick. But yeah, she's doing better now. And literature actually helped her a lot as she recovered. And she was reading the Cancer Diaries.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you sharing that. I really appreciate that. And I'm obviously glad she's doing so well.
Yeah, me too. Thank you.
That's great. The last one we'll talk about is called Heaven. Great title, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And again, if you wouldn't mind, you know, this one, you know, fairly short.
Here goes. Heaven. Turns out heaven is only the future, just these bodies becoming something else. I'm not sure you'll understand. I found no silver sheets of water, no towers of pink boxes carrying plastic babies, no white, none of it. This morning I climbed Black Mountain after Black Mountain, imagined a lover and had him imagine me for an hour. Maybe I could bury our bodies in sugar, have them wash up on the shore of the desert.
Thank you very much. I learned this from taking a children's writing class. You know, we had to write a children's book. Is it harder sometimes to write a shorter poem?
Yes. Definitely. I really do think poems write themselves. So
they do? How come they don't do that for me? They don't do that for me.
Okay, I don't mean that. Okay. I mean an idea comes with a certain amount of language, mm-hmm. I think, and then you kind of reach the end of it sometimes, and then sometimes it keeps flowing. Sure. So I think I could only express this sentiment or these sentiments in this space. Like there wasn't more that I could have written that I didn't, versus longer poems where I'm just writing and writing and writing and it's happening. So it's harder to write short poems because they only give you so much, and then you have to work with what little you have on the page to make something that does all the things that a poem should do.
Mm-hmm. First line, turns out heaven is only the future, just these bodies. Is that line / this poem, is this an optimistic poem?
No.
Not at all, right?
Not at all. Yeah.
Not at all. The image of the image of imagining a lover,
mm-hmm.
is an interesting one. And then to have him imagine you for an hour is so, mm-hmm. cool and interesting.
Thank you.
You know, this is this reciprocity. And again, yeah. All through the imagination, right?
Mm.
The last line has that split between bodies and in sugar. I mean, is that literally just the way it was printed, or is there, what were you trying to do with that?
I can't remember. But so I'm going to have to read it now as with a critical lens. Yeah, I think I wanted to first imply like burial and then give sugar, but give it sooner than I would in a line break.
Okay.
Because like enjambment here would have been cruel in a way, because I don't actually mean, like, I wanted to add some kind of tenderness,
mm-hmm.
by not making the reader wait too long for the sugar.
Sure. The fifth grade me says, well, the sugar is to represent like sweetness.
Mm-hmm.
Is that too simplistic of a reading?
No, I think, yeah, tenderness, sweetness.
Mm-hmm.
I love sugar.
This is quite an interesting poem, you know, short, full of power. Do you, I know maybe it's been a while, do you remember the genesis for this one or any of the kind of ideas?
Yeah, I remember I was back in Wadi Rum in Jordan, mm-hmm. The following year after the residency, so 2019, for a few days. We did like a film festival in the desert. And then I took the ferry over to Sinai in Egypt, and I was there for a while just writing, and some friends were there also. So I was just writing in the hour or two before sunset, and this happened, and I think with Black Mountain, like when you're in Sinai, South Sinai, you can see the mountains across the Red Sea in Saudi Arabia and parts, and then Jordan and other parts. So, and then as the sun sets, they kind of turn black in color. So it was very much coming from what I could see around me, and also my conceptions of heaven from when I was a child. Like I remember my parents telling me, oh, whatever you want, you'll just will happen in heaven with right. before you even think of it or something. So I just imagined a lot of toys and Barbies. So I said plastic boxes of pink babies or something. I just meant Barbies. poets are obnoxious.
Oh man, I appreciate that. Yeah, the childhood image. I always remember thinking that you could like throw a baseball as far as you wanted to or something like that. you could do whatever. Oh man, okay. Right. Yeah, I was wondering about the line with the doll. The question that poetry, either love or hate, what are you working on?
I'm working on my thesis. So I'm revising some poems that I was really excited about when I wrote them, and then looking at them now, I'm like, oh, what is this mess? I spent 6 hours revising a poem yesterday that is based on a testimony that I translated from Arabic by a woman protester who was detained during the revolution and tortured. So I translated her testimony into English, and then I'm working on it.
Is that, you were talking a little bit, I mean, is that with an eye towards publication, or it's kind of like, hey, let's get this done first and then we'll see?
The project, the manuscript?
Right.
I think I'm just getting it done first, and then I'll think about publication after.
Well, the journals and the publishing companies will be knocking down your door, right?
I hope so.
There you go. And it was such a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks for shedding some light on surrealism, on your poetry in general, and really looking forward to reading that when it becomes, you know, a published copy, seeing the cover and the whole deal. You know, thanks for letting me into your brain. You know what I mean? It's really cool to hear about the process. And I do believe you just said, right, 6 hours you spent on
mm-hmm.
that?
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to tell my students that 6 hours for a poem.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you're writing 2 pages of prose, then 12 hours. I don't know.
Exactly.
It was so great talking to you, and continued great luck to you.
Thank you so much. Thank you for your great questions and your like close reading of my poems. I'm so grateful to you. And it was fun talking to you about all of that. Welcome to my brain.
I appreciate that. I mean, there's no other way, right? It's got to be a close read.
Yes.
I appreciate that. As my daughter crawls into the room, thank you for listening to episode, 81 82 of the Chills at Will podcast with Sara El Kamel. You can now subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts and leave me a 5-star review. You can also ask for the podcast by name using Alexa and find it on Spotify and on Amazon Music. Follow me on Instagram, where I'm at Chills at Will podcast, or on Twitter, where I'm at Chills at Will PO1. And Sara, can I have you give your contact info?
Yes. So my website is saraelkamel.com. So saraelkamel.com. I'm also on Twitter as Sara Farag. So SaraFarag. So get in touch. And my chapbook is coming out October 26th. Oh, cool. I think Field of No Justice with the African Poetry Book Fund. They're putting out this box set, and there are 13 books, I think, by African poets. So it's going to be a great collection. So please check that out.
Congratulations. That's great. The Chills of Will podcast is a passion project of mine, a DIY operation. And I'd love for your help in promoting what I'm convinced is a unique and spirited look at an often ignored art form. The intro song for the Chills of Will podcast is Wind Down, instrumental, and the other song played on the episode was Hoops, instrumental by Matt Whitehour. Both songs are used through archesaudio.com. I'm excited to share episode 83 with Larry Strauss on October 5th. I hope you can tune in as I talk to the novelist, teacher, student advocate, and freelance writer who has been published in USA Today and many other prestigious publications. His newest novel, Light Man, is an engrossing read and is out in November 2021. For now, thanks again for listening, and I hope these quarantine days bring you texts by writers with mad skills, like Sara El Kamel, whose work gives you chills at will.